Hello, everyone. Welcome to our special programming for Global Accessibility Awareness Day. You're tuned into CADR 101.9 FM Vancouver, broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. So this is the 12th year of Global Accessibility Awareness Day, which heavily focuses on digital accessibility and emphasizes on how we can make the internet more accessible for folks with various disabilities. It was actually started by a web developer who blogged about it in 2012, urging fellow web developers to recognize the disparity between user experiences. And then someone tweeted that, and it just became viral, which is actually a really cool little fun story. And CADR has been participating in Global Accessibility Awareness Day, or we call it Access Day, because just flows better, I guess. But we've been participating for the past few years, and this is our first show for today. And we have some really great programming lined up. So stay tuned. We've got performances and more interviews to come. But without further ado, today I have a special guest with me, Kyla Jamieson. I've been following her on Instagram for quite a bit, and it's really cool to meet Instagram people IRL. Hi, Kyla. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming and starting us off with Access Day. So Kyla Jamieson is a disabled poet and anti-ableist educator who lives and relies on the unceded traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. She's the author of the poetry collection Body Count, which came out in 2020, which was a CBC Best Poetry Book of the Year. Wow. Congrats. And was shortlisted for the Pat Lowther Memorial Award. Her work reimagines time, embodiment, care, and identity in the aftermath of a brain injury. Thank you again for joining us. And how are you doing today, Kyla?
I'm good. This is fun. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I was actually telling Kyla that I will get her hooked on live radio.
It's entirely possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I am really curious. It's one of those things because obviously accessibility is a heavy topic, and I don't know, there is no kind of like light way to like begin, but something that I've been curious about and thinking about in preparation for our conversation is to hear your relationship and your thoughts on accessibility and performance. So I should also mention that we have a loose theme for today, which is accessibility and performance. And so I at least feel that those two are such broad and perhaps loaded terms. So just curious mm-hmm. to hear about your relationship with them and your thoughts on them.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how you say like access is like a heavy topic, because I think that access actually can be like joyful and beautiful. And the writer and organizer Mia Mangus, who's a longtime disability justice thinker and activist, has described it by saying access is love. And there's so much possibility within access, possibility for connection, possibility for inclusion, different perspectives, and just having a richer experience of the world and of our communities. But I think that where access becomes maybe a heavy topic is when it's not offered. So it's actually the absence of access that creates that heaviness or conflict. But when access is present, it facilitates lightness and presence and connection and joy. And I always describe access by saying it's what allows me to be present And it's what allows me to have those moments of connection with people or with a project or with a dialogue or conversation. And one example I always think of is a friend who lives in Toronto and isn't able to go up and down, say, a flight of stairs. And all these restaurants in Toronto have bathrooms that are downstairs. And she has to plan to not need to use the washroom the whole time that she's out of the house for dinner. So that just interrupts her ability to be present and say, just forget about the needs of her body in that way and just kind of have fun with friends. And then there's also this Cornel West quote that is, justice is what love looks like in public.
I was just thinking about that.
I hope I'm not mangling it, but because I think that access is justice and access is love, and access and justice in public, like that whole idea ties into exactly what Mia Mangus was talking about and is talking about. So I think that actually access is like one of the most loving things that we can do, and it's such a beautiful thing to collaborate on with other people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's funny you mentioned that quote, because I was just thinking about it, and I hear that a lot when people tend to get uncomfortable or sort of like, oh, you're just going to be talking about social justice, and it's really the absence of it. And so I really appreciate you reframing that it's lack of care, lack of access, lack of justice, which creates friction and which is really oppressive at the end of the day. And I lost my train of thoughts because I was deeply
you
listening.
Me to have another thought.
Oh, okay, perfect.
Well, wait, let's see if I can find it now. But so, yeah, in terms of access and the joy that it can facilitate, I think that that's something that when people are having to fight for access, it creates a sense that, oh, access is like this conflict-ridden topic or something.
Yeah.
But that, I think it's not necessarily a conflict between people. It's a conflict between people who want accessibility and value accessibility and people who are married to the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that access is inconvenient or access is a burden. And so it's really just about changing our perspectives and using our imaginations, which is something that the disability community is so good at. But I think that there is a lot of defensiveness that comes up around people asking for access. And the thing is that access does take energy.
Oh, yeah.
And resources and time, because I've organized an accessible reading series and it was a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
I think the more that access becomes normalized and that people all have some familiarity with or understanding around access and some skills around access, the less it's something that gets put completely on one person's shoulders. And then the lighter we can all feel. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
I didn't really answer your question about performance. Like performance as a loaded topic.
We will be talking about performance throughout our conversation, so yeah. It's okay. I think accessibility is a good point to get this started with. And I suppose I have another thought, which I also realize within activism, be it like disability justice, social justice, whatever, the importance of like rage, and that is often like the spark, and you are not apathetic anymore and you want to fight against the status quo, but that can be often weaponized against people. Mm-hmm. And seen as like, oh, like this angry person, and the like discomfort, but we need to be uncomfortable to change things, and that's okay. I think that's when,
I think you're right. Anger can be illuminating and energizing. It can also burn us out.
Yeah.
If that's a mode that we stay in. And you're so right that often people who are advocating for change are kind of put into that box of like, oh, you're just an angry person or whatever. And I think for me personally, just because I've dealt with energy limiting chronic illness, I just don't have the energy to sustain anger constantly. And for me, it's not enjoyable to be in that state. So I always say to be impatient with injustice, not with people. Mm-hmm. But that's also hard to live by because some people really make your blood boil.
Oh yeah. I have a long list, but we will not talk about that.
But I try to always kind of zoom out and put things in perspective. But it is really hard to see the ways that people's ignorance often can perpetuate harm, and the ways that their biases can play out in terms of their impact on other people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I do like that, though. I think it's more constructive to be impatient or place that anger against systems because we're all products of our environment, and it can be helpful to really understand where the other person's coming from versus, like, alienating them. But yeah,
I saw a quote recently that was like to approach everyone as like a potential ally, or to see every person as like a potential activist.
Oh, I love that.
Or potential ally. I mean, it's a nice perspective to try to maintain, but I also always, like, even when I'm, you know, in a maybe like more tolerant state, I also know that when you're really suffering because of inaccessibility and because of ableism, it is really hard to have that patience with people sometimes. And so even when I'm able to be patient, I also always see the value in the people in my community who are pissed off. And I'm like, that is an important role. My role is an important role. We're all playing a role. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we switch and we're playing different roles. Totally. But I think that even if I'm not choosing to, like, stay in my anger, I see the value of it as well.
Yeah. It's not linear.
Yeah.
At all. So for my second question, I'm curious to know more about your work as a performer and a poet, and how does accessibility or lack thereof impact your work and practice?
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, I'm not a spoken word performance type poet. I'm more of like a page poet, as some might call us.
Oh.
So like more about the written word and like the poem as it is on the page. But I do love reading poems. I'm just not usually doing it in like a spoken word context. So I feel like actually a lot of the performance aspect of my writing practice actually maybe happens on Instagram. that's where I'm most often, quote unquote, like showing up publicly, which has been a really interesting thing for me, because when I had my brain injury in 2017, suddenly most things became inaccessible to me. And yet my disability was invisible. And so it's not something that people typically think of as having access needs associated with it. And the access needs that I had are not ones that are commonly accommodated. So that just ramped the inaccessibility up even more. And suddenly one of the only spaces that was accessible for me was like social media. And because I had problems processing like visuals and text heavy, like web pages and stuff and books and everything like that, I had been like a Facebook person because I'm a millennial, and I became like an Instagram person because it was less dense and it was just easier for me to process visually. Mm-hmm. And then that really has become a super interesting part of my practice and like a place that I'll share work or like get people's input. And yeah, that's been really interesting because, for example, when my book came out in spring of 2020, I had these events planned to launch my book that I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to do because they weren't very accessible for me. And then the pandemic happened.
Yeah.
And so then everything's canceled. My publicist was like fired. She was laid off. I think she's back now. I don't know what she's doing. She was awesome. And so I ended up doing the book launch for Body Count on Instagram Live.
That's so interesting.
With another friend who is in Montreal who's also disabled. And so for whom, you know, for us, like these issues of having to do things virtually or being socially or physically isolated, like when all that started happening with the pandemic for the general population, we were like, welcome to the club.
Yeah.
You know, like this is... Not that it wasn't still hard and not that it wasn't a shift, but it was something that we were more familiar with. And I think that's why some people in the disability justice world talk about disabled people as prophets. And that idea that, like, at some point, most people, if they're lucky, will live long enough to deal with some kind of disability. And so... younger people who are experiencing disability and access obstacles and stuff are really just like, you know, maybe having those experiences a few decades ahead of some of our peers, but it's not something that people can typically avoid their whole lives. And whether people want to deal with their ableism now or later is up to them. But like, I have to say, like, ableism and internalized ableism makes dealing with injury and illness and disability real hard. So for me, I'm like, you know, if I'm talking to someone who's totally able-bodied, who's my age, I'm like, you know, if you unlearned your ableism now, you could have a much more peaceful life. Like, you're going to deal with a lot less inner strife down the road.
You're just dropping truth bombs. That is absolutely true. We had an interview... I believe a couple months ago with Madeline, who was on All Access Pass, which is our accessibility collective. And something she said really struck a chord with me. She said, we're all temporarily able-bodied.
Yes.
And we just really take it for granted. And it just ties in.
That's so true.
With what you said. And just on Instagram, it's so fascinating. Because one of my volunteers actually was like, Instagram is LinkedIn for artists. And I'm like, I love that and I hate that. But yes.
I mean, it's kind of true. And it really just is what you make of it. It's like, you know, if it doesn't make you feel good, like maybe don't follow what you're following. Like, I don't know what to tell people. I'm just like,
yeah,
we have choices to make. It's like if you're in a friend group and you're not happy, like, get new friends. If you're on Instagram and you don't like it, follow different people. I don't, I'm just like, it's not an Instagram problem per se if people aren't having a good time in that space. I think when we're talking about people being like temporarily able-bodied, I think the other thing that comes up around accessibility is like, there are so many things that can be framed as access needs that actually make things better for everyone. So such a good example of that is what is called the curb cut effect, which is like we didn't always have those like slopes from the sidewalk down to the street. And it was actually wheelchair user disability activists in San Francisco, I believe, who started just going and like creating their own curb cuts. But now it's like we have curb cuts everywhere. And if you're pushing your bike, walking with a friend along the sidewalk, you use a curb cut.
Stroller.
If you have a stroller, if you're making a delivery with a cart, if you're moving, like curb cuts benefit everyone. And actually, I was reading this morning in terms of web accessibility, alt text, which is the text that we use to describe images for screen readers, is also super important for search engine optimization. And so it's like just another example of how something that's created for accessibility, even like captions on Instagram. If you like watching videos on Instagram with your sound off, those captions that were originally like designed for accessibility, you're making use of them. So there's so many ways that access serves people who don't even identify as having a disability. And it's so interesting how like when you create a space that's really intentional about accessibility, often people who don't really think of themselves as having access needs will also enjoy it more.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, well, you know, maybe that's a reason that we should have more access to make life more enjoyable and more pleasurable.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, like maybe this is just very basic, but inclusion and inclusivity serves everybody and it just increases everybody's quality of life. And so it's sometimes a lot of people get bogged down into the us versus them narrative, mm-hmm. or like, I don't need this, and just have more of a self-serving mindset. But yeah, like as we both have been talking about, this is temporary.
It's such a, I imagine that it's such a hard way to live, thinking of, and maybe because I used to be more like that, is thinking of yourself as not having needs.
Yeah.
Or like trying to not have
That's
needs.
So lonely.
Yeah, I think it was for me. And, you know, I think maybe it's related to like this hyper individualist, mm-hmm. like late capitalism, consumer identity. Yeah, like girl boss hustle culture, you know, ableism, like whatever we want to, however we want to think about it. Like that is not reality. And I think the thing that I like to say to people is like, well, so do you get rid of your own garbage yourself? Like, do you grow your own food? Do you clean your water? Mm-hmm. Like, no, we're actually all so interdependent and dependent on so many different systems. It's just that some people are used to all of their needs already being met by the status quo. And then people who are having to ask for their needs to be met are often categorized as like needy, mm-hmm. or a burden or whatever. But the thing is that everyone would feel needy if they suddenly didn't have water,
yeah.
or mm-hmm. nobody picked up their garbage. Nobody's yeah. truly independent. Yeah,
no man's an island.
No.
Yeah, I just want to say this is such a great conversation, and something else that we were talking about and something that you shared in our email correspondence was around societal expectations and mm-hmm. rigid societal expectations around health and illness. And you've also written about that and talked about that. And so if you just want to touch briefly on sort of what are some of those expectations that either you've encountered or witnessed, and I suppose how do you think we can challenge them personally, professionally, and like communally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for me, like expectations around health is always related to having an invisible illness or disability, and then people projecting certain ideas of what you must be capable of or how you must feel in your body onto someone based just on how they look and then their assumptions. And so I think in terms of combating that, I think there's a few things. It's like people need to be more humble. Like we need to approach people, other people, with humility and not assumptions and not these expectations, and being open to approaching someone with the idea of, I don't know. Like, okay, here's a new person or a person I work with or person I'm interacting with. Let me just ask them, you know, how are you feeling? Like, I think sometimes, I mean, I was talking about this with a friend the other day. She's like, I don't always feel like it's safe for me to out myself as disabled. Partly because she can be met with so much resistance. Like, no, well, you don't look disabled to me. And it's like, okay, well, can we just back that up a little bit? Can we just unpack, like, where all these assumptions come from? And I think this idea, like, there's actually the majority of people with disabilities have invisible disabilities, but it serves, I think, the status quo for people to have this very narrow idea of who has a disability and who deserves to have, say, access needs and have those met. And it's the idea of like trying to maintain this concept of people with disabilities as this dismissible minority that doesn't need to be considered, at a time when with COVID and long COVID, there's just more and more people living with disabilities. And it's actually mm-hmm. a super high, it's like the largest minority group, mm. I think, especially in terms of what I've seen for stats in the States. Mm. So I think just approaching people with the idea of like, listen, just because I can look at you and have certain ideas based on what I'm seeing, that doesn't mean that I know your experience. I think that humility and openness and just like being willing to question things is really important. And I feel like that can go a long way in terms of like any space that we're in, like mm-hmm. professional, personal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And just open to being wrong.
Yes. I did a presentation at like a conference yesterday and someone asked the question, like, in terms of language, because we were talking about disability and brain injury, like, what's your recommendation for either one thing, like, doctors should or shouldn't say to someone with a concussion or with a mild traumatic brain injury? And I was like, it's not one thing that you need to say or something you need to do with your language. It's more about your perspective mm-hmm. and being a person who's willing to say, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just be a human.
Right? Just be a human. It sounds so simple.
It's not.
But we're so conditioned to think of ourselves as machines
yeah.
and operate like machines.
Yeah. No, that's something that, just like a sidebar, offer media ethics training here, and I, again, that could be seen as like a heavy topic, very significant and crucial now more than ever, and I get asked a lot of questions of like, oh, like what if we make mistakes when we're reporting reporting around marginalized communities, and like I have more privilege and so there's a power dynamic, and you will make mistakes. It's okay. We're not perfect, but just kind of the openness that you mentioned and open to being wrong. And then also, I feel like on the other side, I mean, this is a whole thing we can get into that we don't need to, but like around cancel culture and stuff. And so also just like calling people in and being gentle with people learning, but also just kind of the perspective of like, are they actually willing to learn or just trying to dismiss you or impose their expectations or like trying to prove you wrong?
Yeah. Or playing devil's advocate, oh, our favorite.
Should we take a break?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay. So we are going to play some ads.
Baby Girl are breathing effervescent life into a new definition of pop music. The Toronto duo, comprised of college friends Kiki Francis and Cameron Bright, place a refreshing spin on youth nostalgia with a contemporary edge. Their mission statement says it all. Be Still My Heart is a heartfelt collection of songs detailing the bitter and the sweet of love as it navigates feelings of joy and hopelessness. Baby Girl is coming to Vancouver, performing at the Biltmore Cabaret on May 25th. For tickets, go to admitone.com. Start the conversation about accessibility. Access Day is coming up on May 18th. Because accessibility can mean many different things to each person, it's important to continue these conversations about accessibility. By listening to experiences that others encounter and how to make spaces more inclusive by making sure they're accessible for people with unique abilities.
This year for Access Day, happening on May 18th, we want to speak about accessibility in performance. Whether it's as a musician, acting, dancing, sharing experiences, and learning about others' unique abilities is important to create safe spaces for everyone. Make sure to tune in on May 18th for content related to accessibility.
Whoa, hold on. Where are you taking all those cacti?
I need to put them near the radio.
How come?
They love to hear Everly's nature-based music on Dead Succulent Haunt every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CITR 101.9.
Oh, Dead Succulent Haunt? where your plants can grow and you can mourn those you've lost.
Come on, plants, let's grow.
May is Asian Heritage Month in Canada, and this year, the Vancouver Asian Heritage Month Society and its signature event, the Exploration Festival, is celebrating its 27th anniversary. Exploration Festival is a month-long celebration that brings together all of the Pan-Asian Canadian artists throughout the Lower Mainland, including visual, art, poetry, dance, and music. Find all of the events and exhibitions in the online program guide, which you can download at exploration.org to learn more about what's happening in your community this Asian Heritage Month.
All right, and we are back. I realized I was so excited for this conversation that I didn't introduce myself, but it doesn't. Anyway, I'm Hannah, and some of y'all are probably sick of hearing me on the radio
never,
all the time.
Never.
Okay, I have a new fan, if I say so myself. So you're listening to CADR 101.9 FM Vancouver, and you're tuned in to our special programming for Global Accessibility Awareness Day. Our first guest for today is Kyla Jameson, and we've been having such a great conversation around performance and accessibility and invisible illness and disability justice, and we could go on for hours, right?
I think we could.
So Kyla generously offered to do some reading from her book Body Count. And should we?
Yeah, I feel like
going
this,
to that.
I feel like the first poem that I chose is like such a perfect transition from like what we were talking about before, because we were talking about like rage, and
love segues.
So I'll just. It's a short poem. It's called "I Wish My Invisible Illness Made Me Invisible to the Male Gaze." I've spent whole years avoiding men's eyes when I could have been doing things. I'm almost at my favorite plant when a man heckles me. I want to yell, but I'm too tired to speak. I raise one hand and one finger. I feel like that ties back to how I was like, sometimes I'm just too tired to like yell at people.
Oh, yeah.
But it's also, you know, that like the performance of femininity, the performance of able-bodiedness, and then, you know, how that makes you a target of certain types of attention or inattention is something that I always find really interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, absolutely. And just makes me think of like hypersexualization of women's bodies, femme bodies, trans bodies. And it's like, this is not the kind of visibility we want.
No, it's the exact opposite. Yeah, that's not like revolutionary visibility.
No.
Yeah, it's just being a target of certain types of gaze.
Yeah, and yeah. Harassment and mm-hmm. and violence. But yeah, thank you.
Should I read one more?
Oh, yeah, please.
Yeah. Okay, because I feel like this next poem kind of relates to when we're talking about accessibility. It sort of illuminates what the stakes are, because it's a poem that I wrote about 8 months after my concussion, when everywhere was like too bright, too loud, too busy, and I didn't really have, say, like family or anyone around to kind of help me navigate things. So I was just super isolated, and I would have to do things like, you know, walk to the Shoppers Drug Mart like at 10 p.m. with sunglasses on, just like go get something from the store, because mm-hmm. it was like too busy and too loud and too bright during the day. And I remember, I have this in another poem in my book, but like I was waiting in line for something at Shoppers, and this elderly woman who used a wheelchair told me to go ahead of her mm-hmm. because she said I looked like I needed it.
Oh.
And I would seriously get passed by people. Like, I would be walking on the street and people using walkers would be passing me because I was walking so slowly mm-hmm. because my brain just had no energy.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that I didn't have to be as isolated as I was if places and environments were more accessible and if more people had more awareness around invisible disabilities and how to make things accessible. Mm-hmm. And so people always talk in terms of like traumatic brain injury and concussion about kind of like social isolation as sort of one of the challenges that we navigate. And I don't feel like the cause of that isolation is that someone has symptoms. I feel like the cause is that the world isn't accessible, mm-hmm. and people don't have knowledge around accessibility. And I feel like that applies to like a lot of people dealing with different health issues, mm-hmm. whether they identify as disabled or not.
Absolutely. So much, yeah, it just makes me think of how much shame and stigma there still tends to be around mental illnesses, mm-hmm. and performing, being neurotypical.
Yeah, just like feeling like you have to be a certain way to be around other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is just, that's not love.
No.
That's not, like, that's not my vision of, like, what we're striving for.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, I feel like accessibility has this, like, revolutionary energy to it.
Absolutely.
Where it's the potential to, like, shift the texture of our realities, mm-hmm. Which is something that I get, like, really excited thinking about. But I'll read this poem.
Yeah.
It's called In Exile, I Draw the Tower Card. And it opens with a quote from Jane Kenyon. Spruce, inadequate, and alien, I stood at the side of the road. It was the only life I had. When I injured my brain, it was barely spring. Now it is mid-October, and getting up at 11 is a big accomplishment. Last month, I counted the 500 extra hours I've spent sleeping in this new state where sunlight augurs pain. I lose simple thoughts before I can finish them and feel lonely without my mind. I'm always asking whoever I'm talking to, what was I saying? When everyone went back to school, I stayed home, stopped having goals, stopped dreaming of putting my body in a body of water. I tried to edit what I wrote and was bad at it, the kind of bad trying harder can't fix. I felt useless and alive. I watched the doctor type prognosis unknown and let hope ghost me. Remind me where the soul lives, how to tell body from mind. Ups and downs, I say, when asked if I'm recovering. In crowds, I get dizzy and sweat from the noise and movement of bodies around me. I'm a woman who holds her head slightly off center, always comes alone, is relearning most things. Where to begin?
That's lovely. It's just, yeah, so visceral.
I feel like, for me, I feel like that poem just encapsulates, like, so many of the symptoms that made daily life difficult. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I think a practitioner who works with concussion patients had read this and was like, oh, well, like, that doctor was wrong. Like, that's not useful for them to be, like, prognosis unknown. And I'm like, even when he wrote that, like, I knew that he didn't know anything about my health and, like, what I was dealing with. Like, he couldn't really help me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, I think the thing with navigating the world with a disability is that even when you know better, it still affects you to be on the receiving end of people's ignorance.
Yeah,
or their, certainly. Like, lack of, you know, optimism about what you're capable of, mm-hmm. or just like their prejudices.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that's just tiring and draining about moving through the world, mm-hmm. with a disability is, and like, and then having to out yourself as disabled if you have an invisible disability and then dealing with people's misperceptions around disability. Because if everyone didn't have those misperceptions, you maybe wouldn't necessarily have to out yourself, because those would just be conversations that we had,
yeah.
with each other. It's interesting.
Yeah, no, yeah. It can be so draining to, like, really have to, well, self-advocacy, making a case for yourself, to really have to show people that I deserve compassion. But if we were all just a little more compassionate and operated with warmth, because there can just be so much, like, coldness in the world,
mm-hmm.
right? And everybody deserves compassion
and dignity.
Yeah.
I feel like that's something that
absolutely
is really kind of chipped away at when you're living with a disability and just having to navigate, like, either getting accommodations at a university mm-hmm. that maybe is not super great at providing accommodations or, you know, like trying to get, whether it's like income assistance or just something that like you're entitled to. Mm-hmm. But the ways, like the systems that you're required to navigate do not affirm and uphold your dignity and your humanity. And I think that's something that is so draining, and it's something that people who've never had to go through it just don't understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. I know you mentioned wanting to read your last poem.
Ooh, yeah. Okay. I have another poem.
I'm also, before we go into your poem, I am going to be nosy and ask you about the title of the book, Body Count. I was very fascinated by it, and I chuckled. I was like, oh, because just the more mainstream perception of it and pop culture and stuff. And so I love how you call it Body Count. So I don't know if you want to share a little bit about that.
It's so funny because, like, I think body count, you know, has that colloquial meaning of like the number of people that someone slept with, which was, I'm going to just say, like, it wasn't like on the top of my radar when I like chose the title of the book. And like everyone else who was involved in publishing my book was like also not like super attached to maybe like Gen Z or like more contemporary like rhetoric around the term body count.
The lingo. Yeah.
But I think for me, I mean, there's the title poem for the book is called Body Count. And I think for me, like that title partly came because I was writing about like actually a massacre that happened in Nanjing and trying to write back in high school, like trying to write a paper about it and just what history is recorded, what history isn't recorded, what gets investigated, what doesn't, and like what makes its way into what we understand to be quote unquote factual historical information. So that was part of like where the term body count came from, but it's also so much of the book is about embodiment and about the body, and also kind of this insistence that our experience counts, or like our subjective embodied experience mm-hmm. matters. So there were a lot of different meanings, but it is also like a bit of like a, I mean, there's these like love poems in here and like romance and stuff, so it like it kind of fits too, but I wasn't trying to like riff primarily off of that sense of the term body count.
No, I mean I actually think it's so cool, even if this was unintentional, that how you subverted the term, which is really popular in pop culture and social media and whatever, like, is it millennial or Gen Z lingo? Because I personally don't use it. I think body count as it is used can be a bit cringe, and it's often, well, a lot of like a little, well, there's a bit of toxic masculinity of like bragging of like I have these many whatever, but also just like it's a bit dehumanizing. Like, mm-hmm. I slept with this many people. Like, who cares?
Yeah, yeah. It's not, I think that's maybe part of why that wasn't like the meaning or definition at the forefront of my mind, is because it's not really like a, it's not a worldview that I ascribe to.
No.
Or like an idea about around like dating or romance or relationships mm-hmm. that I ascribe to. So I'm happy that I subverted that a little bit.
Yeah. And I mean, don't want to get philosophical. I have to like stop myself. But it's so interesting. Well, body count can mean so many things, but I think of treating bodies as numbers and kind of gamifying it, which you can see in modern dating. Unfortunately, when massacres happened, it's often like, and I see a lot of like how reporting is done in the global south, where it's like, oh, like 1,000 people died, but there's no like humanness to it, versus like if a tragedy occurs in the west, it is more, well, I don't know, it's more thoughtful, and just kind of that disparity and the like hypocrisy and like which bodies matter. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there's just a lot that you can take. So what I'm trying to say is I love the title.
That's such a good philosophical thought about it.
Thank you.
I love it.
Okay, so we have about 5 to 10 minutes. Okay. So maybe if you want to read your last poem or a couple more poems.
Yeah. Maybe I'll just read like one short one and then the last one.
Yeah.
Great. So this next one is called My Life is an Inaccessible Event. I tell myself about my days and dreams, don't RSVP to anything, I could disappear or have already. I think there's this thing that a lot of people experience when they deal with illness and disability, especially if you have an energy limiting illness. When you say don't even have the energy to like show up online, people just don't notice that you're not there. And it's such a byproduct of like our attention culture. And like right now, you know, I asked on Instagram, I was like, hey, you guys, like, I'm going to be on the radio. Like, what do you want people to know about access? And there's actually someone who wrote to me saying that she asked to be able to work remote for her job because I think of a disability, and she actually got fired.
Oh, God.
And then another person was like, you know, I'm immunocompromised, and because we've dropped the mask mandate, there's basically nowhere I can go. Mm. And those are just like everyday occurrences for people in the community, in the disability and chronic illness community. But then it's like for the people who don't have that experience or who aren't really strongly connected to people in the community, it's so easy to just not notice. Mm-hmm. And so this poem kind of came out of like me initially after my concussion, just like having no energy, not being able to be on like Instagram or Facebook or anything, not being able to be anywhere really, and nobody reaching out and being like, hey, like, are you okay? Or like, hey, like, are you around? Or like, what's up? Like, people just simply don't notice sometimes when people drop out of the world. Mm. And that's what's happening with long COVID right now too. There's, you know, possibly like millions,
yeah,
hundreds of thousands of people who are, you know, not able to work or not able to be out, and people who really can't risk reinfection with COVID. Mm-hmm. As well. And I feel like I've seen these kind of think pieces like, oh, like, what's happened to, like, the labor force? And it's like, what do you think happened?
What? Yeah. No shit.
So, yeah, I feel like inaccessibility is something that people really don't notice unless it affects them.
Mm-hmm.
And the absences of people who are experiencing barriers to access are often just sort of dismissed or written off, or, like, you know, people aren't aware of it. So I feel like that was kind of what I was speaking to.
Yeah.
Yeah, with that poem. But yeah, I mean, with, say, the pandemic, all of a sudden so many places did make remote work accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, guess what?
It's possible.
It's possible. Like, at this point, seeing how many things changed because mm-hmm. of the pandemic and how quickly, mm-hmm. seeing things like grant deadlines for like filing taxes, probably like everything we thought could not change could change. And the fact that, yeah, there are now people who are like, this is just the way things are, this is just the way things have to be, we can't do it differently, it boggles my mind. Mm-hmm. I'm like, where were you? Were you not paying attention? Did you know that everything that you think is written in stone
is not?
I would say most of it is not, actually.
Yeah. It is a lot of, I feel, well, because all these things are so ingrained within us, but also, unfortunately, a lack of imagination.
Yeah.
Because our world is so different from what it looked like 3 years ago.
But no, we're back to normal. Air quotes. Back to normal. Like
big air quotes.
Yeah. It's back. It's not. It's really not. And I think that we're doing ourselves and our communities and our collective futures such a disservice by trying to pretend that it is. Mm-hmm. And it's just delusion. It's self-delusion. And I'm pretty opinionated about this. I feel like the long-term effects of COVID, infection and reinfection on people's bodies is still not fully understood, but it's not good.
Yeah.
None of the research says, oh, yeah, it actually makes you healthier. Mm-hmm. It's like now we have more people dying of stroke, more people dying of diabetes, yeah, all of this stuff. And I just think that our inability to tolerate the discomfort of acknowledging that we're not back to normal is ultimately doing us a disservice in the long run. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it's also making our communities weaker because we're not including people who, say, need masks to be a normal thing.
Yeah.
And then it's also so interesting if you look at, like, Asian cultures where, like, people are still masking outside. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, seems okay there. Like, it's like you said, the limits of people's imaginations are possibly, like, one of the biggest issues that we're facing.
Yeah, totally. It's such a barrier. And, yeah, it doesn't serve anybody.
Ultimately. I mean, maybe in the short term it serves people's sense of comfort or something. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean...
As we have predicted, I mean, no, but well, I just want to say we are running out of time, and I still want to hear the last poem, so okay. I'm just going to say thank you so much, Kyla, for coming on our special programming and participating in Global Accessibility Awareness Day with us. This was such a great conversation.
Thank you.
It was, just also lovely hearing your poems and stuff.
Thank you for having me. Yeah. Do you want me to read the last one? Okay. Yeah, this was great. Thank you for convincing me to come on the radio. Okay. This poem, I feel like it's a spring poem. It's kind of still spring right now, even though we're having the summer heat in Vancouver. And for me, this poem kind of embodies some of the care and love and support that is possible between people. It's called I Need a Poem. Can we talk about the moon tonight? Low and full in the baby blue sky. A friend at my door, the sound of her laugh and well-loved heart. I want to be held up like that. I need a poem about happiness I haven't written yet. An ode to the ducks in my neighbor's pool. Another for the pink magnolias of spring. Some trees make it look so easy. Yes, I can hold all this beauty up.
Lovely. That's such a great note to end on. Folks who are listening right now, stay tuned. Next up is Rachel Ransom's live performance. Thanks again, Kyla.
Thank you so much.